2 weeks after Hurricane Sandy, reality is setting in that tens of thousands of homes and apartments in New York and New Jersey won't have power for weeks, maybe months, and money for shelters is now an urgent issue. And people in the hardest-hit areas are getting more frustrated and more angry about the pace of recovery. Residents of New Jersey's barrier islands were allowed back in yesterday for the first time since the storm to see what was left of their property, if anything. Some housing projects in the Rockaways have gotten their power back, and New Jersey has ended gas rationing, but cleanup continues in towns along the coast. That's a bulldozer pushing sand back towards the ocean on the Jersey shore. It's an attempt to restore a beach that was washed away. The storm swept megatons of sand into homes, businesses, and streets, and in some cases across the barrier islands and into the bays behind them. But if you believe New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, all that sand and everything that sat on it will be put back.
And so we will get up and we'll get this thing rebuilt and we'll put things back together because that's what this state is all about and always has been all about.
But should beaches and jetties and seawalls that protect the coast be rebuilt the same way they were before Sandy? With us is Cornelia Dean, a science writer for the New York Times and author of Against the Tide, The Battle for America's Beaches. And Cornelia, beach replenishment or beach nourishment projects have been going on in New Jersey and other coastal states for decades, and they've always been controversial. Have these projects been effective?
They've been effective in some places. They've been highly effective. And in other places, they've washed out, in some cases, before the equipment used to build them has even been removed from the beach.
And of course, from supporters, we hear them say we get these beautiful beachside communities, we get beaches that attract tourists and help the local economy, so they want to rebuild. What do opponents say? Why do they think it's not worthwhile?
What the opponents point to is the fact that the beach does not need this assistance. If you left the beach alone and didn't build on it, the beach would survive intact almost no matter what happens on the coast. The beach would just move further inland to escape rising seas, which is what has happened over the millennia as ice ages come and go and sea levels rise and fall. The problem arises when you put buildings on the beach and roads and infrastructure and so on. And in that case, you have now drawn, it's literally a line in the sand, and the beach is pinned down, and it cannot move easily, and people don't want it to move easily because they want the buildings, they want to preserve the buildings. And so the beach, what you saw in New Jersey, when the sand was washing back and into people's houses and into the streets and into the back of the island, that's the island's attempt to move inland. The island wants to get up on higher ground. And now, as people perennially do in these situations, they want to put the beach back where it was.
And in a place like New Jersey, to keep those beaches in place has involved a massive amount of money, about $800 million.
Suffice it to say, the amount of money involved is enormous.
And the amount of sand involved is enormous.
Yes, absolutely huge. I mean, hundreds of thousands of cubic yards of sand. And an average dump truck carries maybe 10 cubic yards of sand. But what the advocates of these projects will tell you is that when we rebuild a beach, we have a very lucrative tourism economy here, and so for them, the trade-off is worth it.
Could you give us an example of one beach restoration project that's viewed as successful and what it has saved?
The one that advocates cite all the time is Miami. And the beach in Miami by the 1960s had eroded to an absolutely terrible state, and many of the fancy hotels that you think of had no beach. They had seawalls in front of their properties, and people sat out of the back of the hotel by a pool on a deck chair, and the water was lapping up at the foot of the seawall because there was no longer any beach. And the people in Miami, the proprietors of these hotels, were at first reluctant to have a beach replenishment project because it was so expensive. The federal government was going to have to get involved in it. And the federal government was going to insist, when the project was done, that the public have access to the beach. And these hotels didn't like that idea. But eventually the situation got so bad, they gave in, they did a beach replenishment project, they rebuilt the beach in Miami Beach, and it survived a long, long time. It has been kind of re-upped from time to time, but the beach is still there. One problem that they have there, though, is initially anyway, coastal geologists tell me, they did not do a particularly good job matching the sand that they put on the beach with the sand that was already there. They had sand with too high an amount of shell fragments in it, and the upshot of it is that this sand underwent a process called lithification and basically turned to the hardness of concrete. I actually was out there once when I was working on my book, and I thought to myself, I wonder if I could even drive a nail into this beach, and just at that moment looked down and there was a nail on the beach, and I tried to push it in, and I could push it in maybe a quarter of an inch.
And that gets to something you've written about, which is even if you're a supporter of replenishing beaches, it's becoming harder and harder to find sand, let alone the right sand, just any sand.
What a lot of people don't realize is that sand moves up and down along the coast. So it can accumulate in places and wash away in other places. Communities that need sand, sometimes they can find it in an inlet, because a lot of times sand washes back and forth and it kind of drops out and piles up in inlets, and the inlet has to be dredged anyway, so they get sand for their beach out of there. One town that I wrote about in New Jersey, Avalon, has an inlet to the north, and they periodically go in there and take sand out of it and put it on their beach. But if you have to go offshore for sand, which most communities have to do, they're finding that they have to go farther and farther and farther offshore to find good quality beach sand because we're using it up.
You mentioned Avalon, New Jersey. Avalon is a community that's cited as a success story somewhat after Hurricane Sandy. What happened there that made that community fare better than others?
They had a project, the Corps of Engineers built a very high dune. I spoke to someone from the Public Works Department in Avalon, and he said the dune was 20 or 23 feet high, which is very tall. And that dune acted as a buffer. But he said when the town put that project in, they had to go around and talk to all of the people who lived along the beach and say, you people are now going to have an ocean view from the second floor. You're going to have a first floor view of the dune. And he said that they were able to encourage the people in Avalon to sign on to this idea, and they accepted it. But further north, there's a town on the coast of New Jersey called Harvey Cedars, and people there are actually suing because a beach replenishment project would build a dune that would block their ocean views.
Right, and they bought these homes thinking they were getting to see this gorgeous water, and now they're staring at a pile of sand.
Now they're going to be looking at a pile of sand. But as one coastal geologist once said to me, if you can see the ocean can see you. So people really need to think hard about these questions. And until now, most people have not. So maybe, you know, with the advent of this storm, people will start to think more seriously about the dangers of being on the coast.
And that has some people asking whether we should no longer build along the coast, or whether technologies like giant wave-breaking sea gates can protect waterfront communities if we're willing to pay billions to build them. We'll be back after a break for more with New York Times science writer Cornelia Dean, back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with New York Times science writer Cornelia Dean about the challenge of protecting seaside communities from storms like Hurricane Sandy and even everyday erosion. Her book, Against the Tide, The Battle for America's Beaches, is about that very issue. And Cornelia, before the break, you were describing the incredible expense of bringing sand to the beaches, and that sand is getting harder to come by because the supply is running out. At the same time, protective dunes are having to be built higher and higher, which is costing towns more money. And that's upsetting homeowners whose property values could fall because their ocean views are now gone. And then when you throw in rising sea levels and predictions for more damaging storms in the future, this seems to get back to that inevitable question. Do we have to stop building or reconsider building along the coast and maybe even start moving people and buildings away from the water?
There are people who would say everybody who's on the coast should just get out and they don't belong there and it's too dangerous and what have you. And it's definitely true that until relatively recently, in the United States anyway, we did not build right on the beach. Or if we did, we built what people used to call beach shacks, which were shacks. And if they fell down and washed into the ocean, it was no big deal. But now we're building more and more elaborate structures and more elaborate infrastructure at a time when sea level is rising. So I think you definitely have to consider, what is it going to cost us to maintain these things?
Do you see a point where anyone actually says, I know you're wealthy and want a giant house on the water, but you just cannot do it anymore?
What I think will be interesting to watch will be what happens to the federal flood insurance program. Because this is, although backers of the program will deny it, it is, in every realistic way, a federal subsidy for people who live on flood-prone areas on the coast. And if the government or the Congress finally decides that this is a program that we cannot afford anymore, and people actually have to pay the full freight of their coastal living, then there may start to be some changes.
A subsidy because even though the premiums may seem high, they actually don't cover the expenses when these houses are destroyed?
The program has never really been self-supporting. It's only self-supporting in years when there are no big storms. Whenever there's a big storm, it has to go to the Treasury to borrow money. And then it, you know, tries to pay the money back. But in the years since Katrina, I would say there's wide agreement that that money is not going to be paid back. There's too much. We owe too much. And now, this is insurance that if you were going to get it on the private market, you'd have to go to Lloyd's of London or somewhere, because the private insurance industry has pulled away from the coast, and they're not offering this insurance. And if you can get it, it would be hideously expensive.
It's hard to imagine a state like New Jersey saying, fine, we'll just give up our coastal development. I mean, the Jersey Shore brings millions of people and billions of dollars to the state each year. And, you know, we've even heard New York Governor Andrew Cuomo say that we should do a feasibility study to see if we can build a giant seawall, something that would be on the bottom of the ocean floor, and it rises up if a flood is coming to keep the water out. Very high tech, most likely very expensive. Here's what Mayor Bloomberg of New York City said about that.
When you have an enormous harbor like we do in Long Island Sound, even if you spent a fortune, it's not clear to me that you would get much value for it.
Cornelia, what's your take on that? Could there be value in building a very expensive, basically floodgate that rises up from the floor to block the flooding?
All of these questions come down to a matter of dollars and cents. I was talking once to somebody from the Corps of Engineers, and one of these people said to me once, if you gave us enough money, we would build a bridge to the moon. And I thought, you know what? He's right. If you gave them enough money, they would do it. You know, they would figure out how to do it, and they would do it. But the question is, how much money does it take? And do you really want to make the investment? Now, I personally have no idea what the dollar figure would be to build sea gates to block off the harbor and the East River and so on, except that fair guess, it would be immensely expensive. But the infrastructure that you would be protecting is immensely valuable. So you might say, well, this is going to cost a fortune, but we think it's worth it because we don't want to up sticks and take Wall Street out of New York or take, you know, the Empire State Building out of New York or whatever. We have this infrastructure there and we want to keep it there.
And if money were not an object, is there precedent for these systems actually working? Does anyone use them, these big seawalls that sort of pivot up on a hinge?
There are big sea gates in existence in a bunch of places. There's small ones where I am now in Providence has a hurricane barrier that they've used several times. They built it in the late 50s. It was proposed in the late 50s after a couple of devastating hurricanes. They've closed it a few times then to say, you know, protect the downtown Providence, which is low-lying from a surge up Narragansett Bay. So we have that. London has sea gates in the Thames. They had an absolutely terrible flood in the 1950s, and they, as a result of that, built these the Thames Barrier, it's called. The coast of the Netherlands is lined with an enormous set of engineering works that protect that coast from storms. And Venice also has a system of sea gates. The issue is, what is not just the dollar cost of building these things, but what is the environmental cost of operating them? And if you're talking about something that in New York would go into use maybe, you know, every 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years for a really massive storm, the environmental effects might not be that bad. But in a place like Venice, where they have to close them off all the time, and which depends on the flushing of water in and out of the canals to make the place habitable, you start to run into difficulties.
So in terms of the engineering and technology possible to do, but a lot more questions to be asked about whether we actually do them.
I would say environmental issues and so on, and who benefits and who's paying.
Cornelia Dean is a science writer for the New York Times, and she's currently a writer in residence at Brown University. She's also the author of the book Against the Tide, The Battle for America's Beaches. Cornelia, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
And this news note, AAA says the number of Americans driving next week for the Thanksgiving holiday is expected to increase a bit from last year, but they'll be taking shorter trips to save on gas. And the price of gas has gone down 35 cents a gallon in the past month. AAA expects that to drop even more in the coming week or so. And in another type of travel, there's an upcoming shortage of airline pilots expected. So how are airlines preparing? We'll talk about that tomorrow on Here and Now. News is next, Here and Now.